Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm John Gravelius with the Public Defender's Office, and I represent Gib Becker. My bar registration number is 41168. Your Honors, this afternoon I plan to address the first issue in the opening brief, which deals with the admission and use of my client's prior Oregon conviction at trial. If this court has questions on the other issues in the brief, I'll try and address those as they come. Now, Your Honors, this first issue really involves multiple issues and layers of error, but I think the important starting point for this court is the trial court's pre-trial ruling in which it determined that my client's prior Oregon conviction is inadmissible under 404B because it would inflame the passions of the jury. Now, the state in its answer brief does not challenge the trial court's ruling in this regard. Nor does the state contest that this court's decision in People v. Cross is on point and applicable. The state doesn't argue that the prior conviction served any permissible purpose under 404B, and the state doesn't argue that we should not have been able to stipulate to the existence of the prior conviction in this case. Because the state does not do so, it is in no position to argue that it was proper to allow information of my client's prior conviction to be admitted and given to the jury, and to allow the prosecutor to use this conviction in closing argument to invite the jury to make reasonable inferences as to what that prior conviction means in this case. Now below, we ask to stipulate to the existence of the prior conviction, and as the state admits, we ask to preclude the jury from knowing about it entirely. Now under Cross, no more was required of us, and the jury should not have been informed about the prior conviction.
Mr. Grealis, can I just ask you a question about the rule that you're asking us to adopt here or to follow? And I think ultimately the question is, is the stipulation relevant as part of this rule? In other words, I see two possibilities of what you're advocating. One is that if it's a sentence enhancer, the prior conviction just enhances the sentence, that it's never admissible. The second is it's not admissible if you have offered to stipulate. So I guess my question is the stipulation, I mean, in Cross, I think it kind of comes up in the harmless error analysis part of that case. I just wasn't 100% clear of the rule that we're being asked to follow.
Well, the rule would actually be that it should never really be admissible if the evidence otherwise serves no independent purpose in the case. Then it's just unfairly prejudicial and inflame the passions of the jury. And I think
so in that case, if I can interrupt you, so in that case, does the question come down to whether or not this was a sentence enhancer versus an element of the offense?
Well, Your Honor, I don't really think that that distinction would matter, but certainly in this case, is I think I take the state to agree that this was a sentence enhancer. So to any extent that that is a relevant distinction, I would argue that, yeah, it's a sentence enhancer in this case, and therefore directly applicable under Cross. But certainly, even if it's an element, it's a prior conviction, and we should still be allowed to stipulate if we so choose.
All right. Thank you.
Can I follow up on something that you said? You were saying that unless it doesn't serve another purpose. So what context are you thinking of, or are you saying that the law would permit it to be heard before the jury if it served another purpose?
Well, I suppose that would bring it back to the question. I mean, if it is potentially relevant to some other fact other than the qualifying fact of a prior conviction, certainly the trial court would have to determine whether or not it's unfairly prejudicial or inflame the passions of the jury as to any other element of the offense or any other question that might come up at trial. But if the trial court determines that it's only relevant to establishing the status of having a prior conviction, then that should mandate that the jury does not get to hear about it. And so, Your Honors, under Cross, as I've argued that Cross is directly applicable, I guess the question really boils down to is what was the harm, and does this require reversal in this case? But, Your Honors, in this case, the harm from repeatedly telling the jury about my client's prior conviction was substantial, not only because they were told about it, but because the way in which it was used and due to the trial court's ruling before trial. Now, first, the evidence or the fact of a prior conviction in this case was not really admitted for a limited purpose. The prosecutor, as I had mentioned, asked the jury to make reasonable inferences as to what that prior conviction means in the substantive elements of the case, but what reasonable inference the jurors were supposed to draw was never identified either by the prosecutor or by the court in an instruction. And while the court did tell the jurors in this case that they could not use the evidence to determine that my client was more likely to have abused the children in this case, because that information was erroneously admitted in the first place, that instruction was ineffectual. And we get that from cases like Usum and in this court's decision in Cross, in which the jury in that case was actually instructed to only use the prior conviction to satisfy the element of having a prior conviction. Here, the jury was essentially invited to make reasonable inferences, and the instruction really didn't preclude that. And secondly, Your Honors, the underlying facts of my client's prior conviction were not admitted at trial. The jury was simply informed repeatedly that my client had a prior conviction. And the state argues that this mitigates the harm, but I don't think that it does that at all. Because if the jury is simply just told repeatedly that my client has a prior child abuse conviction and then asked to make reasonable inferences, there is no other reasonable inference that a layperson would draw other than my client apparently has a propensity to abuse children. And certainly the prosecutor, when it was arguing to the trial court that it could make this argument, did not identify for the court any permissible inference that we would typically know about in which a jury could use it for. Instead, the trial prosecutor argued that the reasonable inference was that because it happened before, it happened again. And so, Your Honors, I think that the closing argument in this case would have rendered any, limiting instruction ineffectual. But, Your Honors, as I mentioned in the reply brief, the harm here was substantial for another reason. And that's before trial, the trial court made the ruling that this evidence that the prior conduct was inadmissible under 404B, thus telling defense counsel effectively that he would not have to deal with substantive use of this evidence in the case in chief. He was told this before trial, so therefore defense counsel wasn't in any position to anticipate the prosecutor's closing argument or craft a theory of defense to combat this. And as I also mentioned in the reply brief, and this bears repeating, that the trial court made a conditional ruling. It told us this evidence is inadmissible unless you run the defense of reasonable discipline. And there's been no ruling by the trial court that we ran the defense of reasonable discipline. The state does not argue that we opened the door to this evidence in its answer brief. And so we effectively upheld our end of the bargain, but were punished for it by closing argument, and at which time we couldn't call witnesses to run this defense. It was too late. And finally, Your Honors, this isn't a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt. And the verdict in this case was unreliable. The most serious of allegations alleged here against my client came from DS and TO's testimony alone. The most serious allegations were never really corroborated, and the jury was essentially put in a position where they didn't have to only evaluate DS and TO's credibility in determining whether or not these most serious allegations occurred. They got to consider my client's prior conviction based on the prosecutor's closing argument. They also got to consider Chief Mayhew's testimony that my client went around town telling people that he beat DS black and blue. And so, Your Honors, when you're assessing the harm in this case, this court should consider the harm resulting from all the errors. Unless this court has any questions on it.
I've got just two others on two of the other issues, if I can, Mr. Gavelius. First, on the issue about Remington House and the reason DS was there, could you remind me, did the court make a 403 determination on that?
If my memory serves me correct, I think it did initially, just finding that it wasn't relevant as to the contested issues at trial. And
that it would lead to kind of mini trials?
Sort of a mini trial on the side. I believe that's what it did rule initially.
Okay, I just couldn't remember. And then with respect to the officer, the hearsay confrontation clause issue, I know that in your brief you're arguing both the federal and state constitutional provisions. In the trial court, was the objection made on both state and federal constitutional grounds on the confrontation issue?
Your Honor, I actually don't remember what was made in terms of the Constitution. I know we made a hearsay objection. Beyond that, my memory doesn't serve me correct in terms of whether or not, whether or not we constitutionalized it.
As you say that, you may be right. I'm not sure they even made the Confrontation Clause objection, so that may be the answer to that question. Thank you very much.
Are there any further questions, Your Honors? Then I'd like to reserve the balance of my time, if I may.
Thank you, Counsel.
please the court. My name is Jay Fisher, and I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. Regarding the first issue, the people are asserting that, in fact, this issue was an example of invited error on the defense's part. To explain this, it involves a certain degree of factual inquiry regarding this particular matter. At the start of the case, the defendant moved in limine to both either seek a stipulation as to the Oregon conviction or to exclude it entirely. It's important to note that his stipulation proposal, at least to the trial court, provided no guidance as to where the trial court was supposed to use this or how it was in fact supposed to use this. So an appropriate inquiry here is, what is a reasonable trial court supposed to do in that instance? And that is, they're going to use this stipulation as it would in any other instance and eventually provide it to the jury.
Well, where does the "as they would in every other instance" come from? I mean, you've got cases like Old Chief, you had cases like Cross that were out there. I guess I have some concern, Mr. Fisher, that you're assuming that by stipulating they were intending it to go to the jury. There are a lot of cases where you just stipulate, look, for purposes of the sentence enhancer, I'm not going to go there, so I'll stipulate here. And I'm wondering whether you're assuming too much. And I recognize you aren't the trial lawyer. And you may have done it very differently. But I'm not sure where that assumption comes from. What's inconsistent with saying, we will stipulate here that we got a prior, and arguing at the same time, and the jury shouldn't hear about it? Which is what Mr. Gavelis is arguing, that was their position.
I understand, but I think that you have to look at the transcript in this particular matter. First of all, it's important to note that the defendant did not argue Cross in the trial court below. Cross appeared when it appeared before this court on appeal. In fact, the defendant relied heavily upon Old Chief, and there is reference in the transcript where the trial court reviewed Old Chief prior to making its ruling. Old Chief does not stand for the proposition that a jury cannot be informed of a stipulation of a prior conviction. Old Chief stands for the proposition that a jury can be informed of a bare bones existence of a conviction, but you can't get into the details in the matter. The details, in fact, would be prejudicial. So that is what the trial court at least relied upon in this particular instance when it came up with the stipulation that it formulated and told the parties that, in fact, it was going to do in this particular case. Going back to actually the factual pattern of this particular matter, it's important to note that the prosecution wanted not only the existence of the conviction to come in, but it wanted the actual meat and bones of the particular conviction to come in too. It was prepared to put on testimony regarding what happened in Oregon. Again, it was to address the defendant's contention that in fact his treatment of the children was reasonable, at least in Colorado. Now, sort of graphing this out, you have a situation where the defendant says, I want none of this coming in. The prosecution wants all of it to come in, and the trial court, sort of in a King Solomon type decision, splits it and says, according to Old Chief, I'm going to allow the existence of the conviction to come in, and basically a recitation of the case, title, the conviction itself, as well as the case number. And that's it. That's what's coming in.
And I guess I'm going to push back on you just a little bit and push back on me. And Old Chief, I mean, as I recall it, the court talked about sometimes the name and nature of the offense can be so prejudicial. I mean, here, the name of the offense, the prior offense, is child abuse. I mean, why? I mean, I guess I'll come back to where you started. I'm not getting how this is invited error, when the defendant is throughout saying, I don't want the jury to hear about this, period. Now, I'll stipulate that he had it for purposes of satisfying that element, but the name comes out, and I don't know that the jury has to hear much more. Maybe I should ask it this way. What is the possible relevance of, once the court says this violates 404B, what is the possible relevance of the jury hearing that the man had a prior conviction for child abuse?
Well, it's my understanding, at least, that the 404B evidence was pertaining to this separate issue of the prosecution wanting to put on evidence regarding the reasonableness of the defendant's actions and the Oregon evidence to come in and refute that potential defense of the charges. That was, at least, was my understanding of what the 404 was.
Yeah, and I think Mr. Gavelis agrees with that, and he said, okay, we won't put on the reasonable, you know, discipline defense, and the court says, okay. So I'm not going to let them put on the evidence. So why does the jury, why should the jury get to hear anything about there's a prior conviction for child abuse?
Well, again, going back to the whole idea of the invited error, it's because the defendant in this particular matter made the existence of the conviction actually an element that the jury had to determine as well, when once you start looking at the conclusion of the case and the jury instruction conference in this matter. In this particular issue, the defendant was told by the trial court, this is the charge I'm going to provide to the court, and it in fact references that the prosecution has the burden of proving that there was a prior conviction before, and he states no objection to that particular charge. Not only that, but they submitted the verdict form, which says that the jury has to determine whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty of a second or subsequent offense of child abuse. Again, the defendant stated no objection to that particular matter. So, and then there's also another point here that has to be raised as well. The defendant stated during the jury instruction conference, the prosecution has the burden of proving each and every element of the offenses beyond a reasonable doubt. The problem is the holding in Cross and Apprendi both say that a trial court can make the determination of a prior conviction at least at a level of preponderance of the evidence. However, a determination of beyond a reasonable doubt is reserved exclusively for the jury. So basically he's saying everything here is for the jury to determine. This is not anything that the trial court can determine. So based upon that, it had to be a jury determination. So to come back later and say, well, it should have never went to the jury, that's another point that we're raising up why this in particular was an invited error in this instance.
That's because he was arguing a proof beyond a reasonable doubt burden.
That's correct.
What you're saying? I'm having a hard time getting to where you're getting to, I think,
okay,
because of the statements supposedly made by the defendant. If he's arguing that it's beyond a reasonable doubt,
that's correct,
then your argument is that means that it must be an element of the case rather than a sentence enhancer, and then it's inappropriate for the defendant to come back later and argue that this is a sentence enhancer. Is that what you're saying?
That would go to our argument why Cross is inapplicable here. And regarding that particular argument, at least, while Cross does say that if it's a sentence enhancer, that can be determined by a trial court beyond a preponderance of the evidence standard, the particular issue we're dealing with here is something that's slightly different. This is a sentence enhancer and then something else. I don't know what you call it. I don't know how you define it.
Here, it's a sentence enhancer. You're saying
in this particular instance, yes, it's a sentence
it
enhancer
is a sentence
and
enhancer.
Then something else, though, is what I'm trying to argue. Because if you look at the actual statute itself, 18.6.401, subsection 7E, there are actual factual determinations that are built into that as well. The first and most obvious of these is that the out-of-state offense must meet the elemental definition of child abuse under Colorado law. So there has to be some kind of deeper factual analysis here that needs to be conducted to actually meet the elements of that particular statute. I mean, a traditional sentence enhancer in Colorado is something that's much easier to determine. It's the existence of a previous conviction that's in the same classification, such as a prior felony or a second or subsequent conviction under Colorado law for the same offense, something that can be determined easily off the face of the documents itself, the certified documents of the old conviction. This particular instance within the statute, the child abuse statute, this particular subset requires a deeper analysis. So based upon that, we would say that Cross is in fact inapplicable in this particular situation. But again, that's sort of going to the question that you're addressing, Your Honor, as versus the uninvited error.
Well, let me ask you did the prosecution have to prove the criteria under 18.6.401.7E in order to prove the crime of knowing or reckless child abuse not resulting in injury, or criminally negligent child abuse not resulting in injury?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to understand the question, if you don't.
Well, there are a couple of crimes defined by the statute.
That's correct.
Two of them are child, knowing or reckless child abuse not resulting in injury.
That's right.
And criminally negligent child abuse not resulting in injury. And then there are provisions in 7E that talk about when an offender has a prior conviction and under other circumstances listed in the subparagraphs there, then those offenses become a fifth-class felony, right?
Well, they, in this particular case, the fifth-class felony would be the second conviction or the second or subsequent conviction, whether it's in Colorado or out of Colorado. But it was my understanding, at least...
So you're saying that those are separate offenses?
The out-of-state convictions, is that what you're referencing, Your Honor?
I'm talking about... Are you saying that knowing or reckless child abuse not resulting in injury is one criminal offense as defined under 1A of the statute, and then knowing or reckless child abuse not resulting in injury when an offender has a prior conviction that would have been a child abuse conviction in the state of Colorado and has one of the other criteria of the subparagraphs of 7E, that's a separate, different, distinct criminal offense?
I don't know if I necessarily want to go that far as to say that it's anything separate. I think it depends on how the particular charging document words the offense against a defendant in a particular case. I mean, I can say with certainty, at least in this particular instance, the prosecution was proceeding under the theory that the defendant's conduct established a continued pattern of cruel punishment, which is what they were proceeding under 7E. So, I mean, again, I think it would depend on a particular case and how it's charged by the state. And all I can testify about is how it was charged in this particular matter. So in response to your question, I think it would be a case-by-case inquiry. And in this particular case, it was the defendant was charged with this continued pattern of cruel punishment. And that's how that in itself would be a separate crime, and that's how, in fact, it was charged in this particular matter.
Let me ask a related question. I think I understand the argument you made about 7A. Here, let's assume for a minute we don't have the stipulation, we don't have any of that. Is it your position that Apprendi and Blakely would have required the jury to make the finding that the acts committed in Oregon would have constituted child abuse in Colorado?
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm saying that because there's this deeper factual inquiry that needs to be made regarding whether the out-of-state conviction constitutes child abuse under Colorado law, that deeper factual inquiry would in fact make it a jury question.
And again, and because it's a jury question, it's not strictly a sentence enhancer.
That's correct. Again, it does have the effect of appearing like a sentence enhancer because it bumps it up from a misdemeanor to a felony. But again, it's just this something else that's added onto it as well that creates an issue.
Mr. Fisher, do you have any legal authority you can cite to, maybe in a different context, that supports that interpretation of this being a sentence enhancer plus?
Unfortunately, I don't, and I did look.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, okay, most of the cases, almost all the cases I've seen, talk strictly about sentence enhancers. But again, the sentence enhancers that I've seen talk about very simple inquiries, that being a certain category of crime, whether it's a previous felony or whether it's a second or subsequent conviction for the same offense.
Okay, thank you.
And if Your Honors have no further questions, we ask that you affirm the conviction below. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Gravelius, you have a little over 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, I want to clarify a couple points in the record. I disagree with the state's interpretation of the record in terms of what we argued below. The state suggests that we argued in the alternative, either we stipulate or we remove everything from the jury. I don't think we argued a disjunctive there. I think in our motion for limine, we made clear on the front end that we wanted to stipulate and we wanted to remove all this information from the jury's consideration. That would be the point of the stipulation.
So if I understand what you're saying, the stipulation was, I'm not going to require anybody to prove this?
I think it was to allow the court to make that finding on its own.
All right, so the stipulation was, court, you don't need to make the finding, or jury, you don't need to make the finding? I'm having a little bit, help me with the context of it.
Okay, Your Honor. Yeah. I think what that means is that the defense counsel is asking for the court to accept the stipulation, meaning the court can make that finding that it's, you know, been satisfied, and that therefore the jury does not need to make that.
So your point is the stipulation then was not to minimize the effect on the jury, but it was just separately, court, you don't need to make the finding.
I guess I'm not quite understanding, okay. Your Honor. The purpose of the stipulation was, well, we wanted to stipulate to allow the court to find it, and we did not want the jury to hear about it. I think it's, you can't really take them separately. By telling the court we did not want the jury to hear about this at all, we are in effect telling the court that you can take the stipulation.
So even if there was an Apprendi issue here, it's satisfied for purposes of 7E. The stipulation was, I think that's, let me say it to make sure I think we're tracking. The stipulation here was, forget it, and I recognize it wasn't directly addressed, who has to make the determination. It was, this element is satisfied. That there was a prior that would get you the bump up if you have to get there.
Correct.
Okay.
And just to further the record on that, Your Honors, on the 15th of December, I believe that was the third day of trial, before the court read the stipulation of the jury, we re-raised our objection, informing the court, no, court, you did not do what we asked. We were actually asking to stipulate and to preclude the jury from knowing anything about this. So I don't see this arguing in the alternative that the state is suggesting. We just clearly did not want the jury to have any information about this, and that the court would just accept the stipulation.
Mr. Grevelius, I know this is your rebuttal time, but I want to ask you, you made a statement in your earlier argument that you didn't think it made any difference whether this was an element of the criminal offense or a sentence enhancer. So are you saying that if this is an element, you think it should not have gone to the jury either, that the jury should not have heard about the prior conviction, even if it was an element of the crime with which defendant was charged?
Under the circumstances here, yes, Your Honor, because it's a fact of a prior conviction. I think we're allowed to do that, and that's my position. But my position, first and foremost, really is that this is a sentence enhancer, but that nonetheless we should still be able to stipulate.
So your primary position is that it is a sentence enhancer?
Right. My secondary is that it doesn't matter.
Okay. All right.
Well, let me ask you, and maybe you're going to get to this, Mr. Grevelius. I'd like you to respond to Mr. Fisher was talking about on that there was no, is it accurate that defense counsel below did not object to the elemental jury instruction or the verdict form, both of which had this provision in there that said, you know, you got the prior?
That may well be correct, Your Honor, but I was going to address that, because when defense counsel on the 15th of December re-raised this objection, as I read the record, now I could be wrong, this occurred before the jury instruction conference, and the court at that time made its ruling clear. So once defense counsel's dealt that hand, I don't understand the basis for the objection. Once the court's made its position clear that it's going to read the stipulation aloud to the jury, I don't really think it would make sense for defense counsel to, again, object to the jury instructions. We certainly don't have to re-raise objections once a court's made a definitive ruling. Now, again, I may have the record wrong, but that is how I read the record, that the jury instruction conference came after the trial court's sort of definitive ruling on this. And so, Your Honors, I don't really have anything else to add on this issue, but I think based on the repeated injection of prior criminality and its use, and the trial court's pretrial ruling that effectively cabined our defense, the verdicts in this case were not reliable, and this court should therefore reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Both counsel, we appreciate your helpful arguments. They will be helpful to the court in reaching its decision. And this matter will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused. Thank you.